Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film awards season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
Remember the pundit saying they will never elect two women to the United States Senate. And then they said, when you looked at them to say, well, if they're both good, you know, why not? And then they'd say, well, they'll never elect two women from Northern California to the United States Senate. And, well, what's the difference, you know, what part of the state you're from? You're going to work for everybody. And then the real question came. How would they ever elect two Jewish women to the United States Senate? And I mean, this was what they wanted to say when they started, but they couldn't get it out until you finally pressed them. And then the answer that I always found myself giving is, look how long we've elected two Protestant men and nobody ever said a thing about it. I mean, what was the problem, you know?
Two Jewish women have been senators from California since Barbara Boxer joined Dianne Feinstein in Washington back in 1983. Boxer announced this morning that she'll leave her seat next year. We'll have more on that later. First, a manhunt is still underway in France for the two brothers who attacked the offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo yesterday. They killed 12 people, and there's been more violence. Today, a policewoman in Paris was shot and killed. Last night, shots were fired at a French mosque, and an explosion destroyed a kebab shop next to another one. French police haven't directly linked the latest incidents to yesterday's attack, but some say the situation could fuel Islamophobia and stoke an already raging debate in France over Muslim immigrants. Juan Cole is a Middle East expert and history professor at the University of Michigan, and he argues that that could be exactly what the gunmen wanted. He joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, why would these gunmen, these terrorists, want to fuel anti-Islam sentiment?
Well, the problem with a terrorist organization that wants to recruit people is that most people don't want to join a terrorist organization. And you have to sometimes give people grievances that would make them unhappy. And then you can recruit them. And then you gain in power. So being mean to your own people is very common in these kinds of situations. I lived in Beirut in the early years of the Civil War there, and the Falangist militia shelled a cookie factory in the Christian area, and they were a Christian militia. And I was very puzzled as to why they were doing that. And then I asked around, and they said, well, the cookie factory is out of commission. The workers there don't have anything to do, and then you can pay them a pittance and recruit them in the militia as their job. So this is the kind of thing these groups engage in.
Law enforcement saying that these gunmen have ties to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda put Stéphane Charbonnier, the editor of Charlie Hebdo, one of the people murdered, on a hit list long before the attack. You can't know now, but from what you've studied and what you know about the region and of violence in the region, do you think that Al-Qaeda may have directed this attack, or that it was solely motivated on the parts of these gunmen?
Well, that these terrorists were linked to Al-Qaeda is not in doubt. In fact, one of them, Sharif Kouachi, was a recruiter for Abu Musab Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia and Iraq, and did jail time for having run a ring to bring French Muslim boys out there. So, and then he was involved in a jailbreak scheme to get an Algerian member of the Armed Islamic Group, which is an Al-Qaeda affiliate, out of French jail. There are very substantial ties between these brothers and various Al-Qaeda affiliates. Whether they're in an organization so tightly that there's a command structure and they were told to do this by Ayman al-Zawahiri, I couldn't say at this point, but that it was suggested to them by Al-Qaeda Central or one of the Al-Qaeda affiliates seems to me very likely.
Let's talk about France and its Muslim population. It has Europe's largest Muslim population. And what's the atmosphere right now in the country? What was it before these shootings?
Well, the situation of the French Muslims is always a difficult one, but for class reasons and to some extent cultural reasons, and not because of these kinds of terrorism or fundamentalism concerns. France is a country of 66 million. There are about 5 million Muslims in France. The vast majority of them are from North Africa, from Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. And many of them originally came, these families, as guest workers. So they were construction workers, factory workers. They were often had been villagers in their home country. They weren't a highly educated group of people. They probably weren't literate enough to be fundamentalists. They were traditionalist Muslims. And then the children and the grandchildren, a lot of them fell away. So only about a third of French Muslims say that they are religiously observant. And a lot of the young people don't know Arabic anymore, often just don't practice very much. So they're an immigrant community, and they're in between. And they in France, the custom is to have the slums on the outside of the city, in the mm-hmm. where we put the suburbs. And so many French cities have a ring of slums around them that are disproportionately Arab. And there's a disconnect between where the jobs are and where people are living, similar to what happened, say, in the United States in Detroit. So there are problems of unemployment and discrimination. And if you send in a job application with an Algerian name on it, it's about three times as likely to be rejected as if it had a French name on it.
Still, there seems to be some tension within Paris among the intellectual elite over Muslims in the country. Le Suicide Français, that's a best-selling essay from last year, argues that mass Muslim immigration is destroying French secular values. You had a book actually published this week by Michel Houellebecq, which imagines a Muslim president winning in 2022, enforcing polygamy and religious schooling. And he's a best-selling author in France and a leading intellectual. So it seems that that conversation is going on, at least among the intellectual elite in France.
Well, yes, on the French right. I mean, it's first of all, although there are 5 million Muslims in France, these are residents. Not all are citizens. Of the ones who are citizens, many don't vote. It's not clear which party they would vote for. Some of them are not exactly socialists. On the other hand, they're repelled by the Gaullists. The idea of the French Muslims dictating French politics is slightly absurd, or Houellebecq's, you know, paranoid fantasies about Muslims taking over tell us much more about Houellebecq than they do about the situation in France.
So you don't think that there is a bubbling of anti-Muslim sentiment amongst the elite and people in power that could translate into different policies now?
Well, were the Gaullists to get in, if Nicolas Sarkozy, the former president, who's the right-wing president, got back in, I mean, I think they have a choice, the right wing in France. They can go in the Greek direction and sort of legitimize a far-right, racist, almost fascist party, like the National Party led by Marine Le Pen. Or they can stand against her and what she promulgates, which, you know, has a very smelly provenance. I mean, you go back to the discourse of Vichy France under the Nazis, really, to find this kind of racism. I think the French right is going to be, you know, faced with a task of how to go forward with this. And if they go the easy route, which is to appeal to people's worst emotions, then things could turn very bad.
Juan Cole, history professor at the University of Michigan and a Middle East expert, and he runs the blog Informed Comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, why our tech regular says, je ne suis pas Charlie, and we go to the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas to see what the future holds. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. More than 150,000 tech reporters and gadget heads are crammed into every available hotel room in Las Vegas this week for the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES. Across 2 million feet of exhibition space, thousands of companies from startups to multinationals are showing off their next big things. And the theme this year is the Internet of Things. Here to tell us more about the CES experience is Casey Newton. He's the Silicon Valley editor of The Verge online tech magazine. Hi.
Hi.
Okay. Well, how are you holding up?
Well, it is Thursday of CES. We've been here for 5 days now, so we have settled into a kind of despair, like an exhausted malaise, but we're going to keep on keeping on here till the end.
Well, thank you for that. And why don't you tell us some of the gadgets you've seen, some of the weirdest, wackier gadgets?
Sure. So, look, the big trends of the show are things like the Internet of Things, cars that drive themselves, you know, wearables like watches. But there's some really weird stuff here. The number one weirdest thing that I've seen is definitely the Belfi stick. This, you may have heard of the selfie stick, an innovation to let you, you know, take a selfie without having to ask a friend. The Belfi stick is so that you can take a selfie of your butt. And so this is an $80 stick that kind of curves around so that you can get the perfect angle to sort of share your derriere on Instagram. Completely insane.
I think that does say it all there.
Yeah, yes. But I guess that's not even really electronic. It just got a lot of buzz yesterday. We also saw some electric roller skates, which look like absolute death. You sort of take these electric skates and you strap them onto whatever shoes you happen to be wearing, and then they sort of power you down the street. And everybody who I saw wearing them looked like they were about to keel over. And I'm really not sure who the target audience is there either.
Well, is there any gadget there that you thought, oh my gosh, I have to have this? Like, this is really going to change my life and I want it now? Aside from the Belfi stick.
Belfi stick would be strong number one. Coming in at number two would be the self-driving cars. You know, I think a lot of us still think of self-driving cars as futurism, and it is, but man, they really are making progress on this very quickly. And it's not just Google that's doing it. Mercedes, BMW, and Ford all showed off some self-driving features in their cars that you're going to see being gradually integrated into cars over the next several years. So that actually does get me excited. I'm a big believer in the idea that autonomous vehicles are going to save lives out there on the road.
Yeah, I heard that Audi actually drove its car, whatever, had its car drive them from Silicon Valley or the city of San Francisco to Las Vegas. Is that true? Did that actually happen?
Yeah. Yes, that's what they say, and I take them at their word. And that's exciting to know that that sort of thing is possible, and we're going to start seeing more and more of that, particularly in dense urban areas where we have really good maps, where the technology is able to get around town. The one caveat is that if it starts raining, autonomous vehicles just stop working completely. We have not figured out a way to get them to drive in the rain yet safely.
Well, thank goodness for global warming, because there's no more rain here in Southern California.
It's a blessing in disguise.
Anyway, what about this Internet of Things? And for people who don't know what it is, can you briefly describe it?
Sure. It's a horrible name, and none of us have been able to come up with a better one. Maybe some of your listeners will be able to. But it basically just means connected devices. So the idea is that one gadget in your house can communicate with another gadget. So the classic example, which we're all still waiting on, is that your refrigerator will sense when you're running low on groceries like milk, and it can just order them for you. Or maybe when you're at the grocery store, you can check in and your refrigerator will say, hey, don't forget to pick up some milk. That's been an example for the Internet of Things for what feels like a decade, and it still isn't a reality, which kind of shows you how slow progress has been. But we did hear a lot about it this year, primarily because Samsung is making a big push into it. You know, Samsung sort of became very popular for its smartphones and tablets over the past couple of years, but those sales have started to slow down. So they're looking for the next big thing, and they're saying that it's going to be the Internet of Things. And so they want their technology to be in your dishwasher and your washing machine and your refrigerator, and they made a huge pitch for that. My problem is that usually when people talk about the Internet of Things, they describe the most mundane tasks that mankind has ever attempted. So, like, on stage, Samsung is like, you know, you turn your light switch on and your toaster will start. You know, it's like these are not problems that people have. So the Internet of Things remains sort of a pretty boring technology for now, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, is there any example of an Internet of Things gadget that you might actually want?
I mean, a fridge that can, you know, communicate with me in real time or can order my groceries, that gets me pretty excited. Some of the smart locks are pretty cool. So the idea is you no longer need to carry your keys around, because once your smartphone gets within a short distance of your front door, the door will just open automatically. And what's even cooler is that if, you know, say you have a guest coming, you can just send them like a single use code and they can enter that into their smartphone and get into your house without needing to borrow a key. And that technology actually already exists. August Smart Lock is a maker of a smart lock and introduced that technology last year. So that is one kind of connected home technology that I think is pretty nifty.
I guess, but then that really raises the whole issue of hacking to another degree.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you ask around, there are a couple of really big issues with the Internet of Things, and security is right up there, right? Like, once you network all the devices in your home, you just have to hack one of them, and all of a sudden, you know, people with bad intentions can do a lot of scary things. So it has to be the first priority for anybody who's looking to connect these devices.
Okay. Well, good luck for the rest of the week.
Yeah, I have my Delphi stick here. I have some work I need to go do.
Okay. I can't wait to see that on the internet. Casey Newton, Silicon Valley editor of the online tech magazine The Verge. And thank you. My pleasure. Are you a gadget head? Do you have any ridiculous tech gadgets that should never have been made, or gadgets that you just can't live without? Tell us about it on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play, or you can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. During the coverage of yesterday's Paris attack on Charlie Hebdo, a lot of news organizations avoided showing the controversial cartoons depicting Muhammad. CNN, the Associated Press, and others blurred or cropped out those images. But conservative commentators took issue with that. They said that those same news organizations had no problem publishing photos that are offensive to Christians. So what did the AP do? It went back to its archives and started pulling photos from decades ago. Joining us now to discuss that and other web-related news is Alex Goldman. He's co-host of the podcast Reply All. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Well, tell us exactly what the AP did.
The AP first posted pixelated photos of the magazine because it contains satirical depictions of Muslims. And then the Washington Examiner noted that it pixelated those cartoons, but it left images of Piss Christ, which, if you're not familiar with it, is a crucifix in a jar of urine that has been a very, very controversial piece of art for many, many years on
their
website.
Since the late 80s, it's Andres Serrano's work. Yeah.
It was a huge flashpoint for cutting funding for the National Endowment of the Arts. And so the AP, rather than saying, you know what, we should probably unpixelate these pictures, actually ended up just taking down the pictures of the Piss Christ work of art. So.
So I guess once you start there, where do you stop?
I mean, I'm not often a fan of slippery slope arguments, but this really does feel like the classic slippery slope argument. When you start censoring based on the intimidation of potential religious extremists, yeah, where do you stop?
Well, I wonder if they didn't blur out the images of Muhammad for that reason, in terms of offending, but just because they were afraid they would be attacked.
Yeah, possibly, but I mean, it's newsworthy, and they are one of, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of news organizations. What's the likelihood that people are going to attack the AP? And part of I mean, the old adage, right, is that you afflict the comfortable and you comfort the afflicted. That's the risk you take when you do news.
All right. So you have a kind of controversial take on Charlie Hebdo. I understand you don't really support, despite this tragedy, you don't really support the type of satire that this magazine published.
I will say that I don't think that in any circumstance anybody should be killed for things that they say, satirical or otherwise. But I think that if you look at the cartoons that Charlie Hebdo is actually doing, they are basically of the quality that you would find on like neo-Nazi website like Stormfront. They're like ridiculous. A lot of them were ridiculously racist. I saw one when I was reading about this that portrayed Boko Haram, the women who were kidnapped by Boko Haram and forced into sex slavery, as welfare queens. Like, it's not highbrow. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be punching down rather than punching up. And the best satire is satire of people who are in power rather than people who are afflicted. And the Muslim community in France has a very complicated relationship with the country at large.
Although many have said that they were equal opportunity offenders.
I kind of don't buy that. It seems like, yes, they weren't afraid of offending everybody, but Charlie Hebdo did take sort of special delight in satirizing and ridiculing Muslims, who are a pretty controversial and afflicted minority within France. So, like I said, I don't condone any murders, but I do think that the I Am Charlie Hebdo campaign, like, I don't want to associate myself with sort of racist caricaturists.
Okay, let's move on to something that Adam Sternberg in Vulture wrote about, and that is Twitter etiquette, about how there are all these unsaid rules about what you post and don't post on Twitter. And apparently, I have been breaking a pretty big rule, unbeknownst to me, and that is you don't retweet your praise.
Yeah, that's right. I can't believe that you've been breaking that rule, Madeline.
Well, here's what I thought Twitter was for. Was basically for self-promotion, an advertising tool.
Oh, no. No. Twitter is, listen, this is the best way to use Twitter, especially if you're a broadcaster, is you can connect directly with your listeners, answer their questions, communicate with them. But if all you're doing is retweeting your praise, the people who are following you, they already like you, generally. So they already know this stuff. They don't care. I'm sorry I'm laughing at you.
Are you really laughing at me?
A little bit.
Okay. Okay, I'm exaggerating a little bit. I don't only retweet my praise, but I do it in the sense that, oh, someone says, oh, I really like this segment that I'm listening to on Press Play. It happens to be called Reply All, and I can't get out of my car because it's so interesting, and here's a link to it. I'll just retweet that so that others who perhaps didn't have the opportunity to hear the brilliance of Alex Goldman would be able to have that opportunity.
I sort of feel like it's much easier to do that if you're tweeting as a brand rather than as a person.
I am literally tweeting as a brand. Just had to put that out there. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, wow.
I know. unfollow. I can hear the unfollows.
I think that, like, when we tweet as a Reply All, our podcast, yes, we do occasionally retweet people saying, like, I like this episode, just to try and get a few more clicks on our website. But generally, if we are retweeting other people, it's because they said something funny or clever or something that we agree with, not because they are retweeting or not because they're tweeting praise about us.
All right. So I'm never going to praise you on Twitter, just telling you.
No, I love praise. I'm just not going to retweet it.
I know, but I'm being that petty that I'm not going to praise you now.
I don't. It seems that's cruel, but it's fair. I don't blame you.
All right. Let's move on. Speaking of anxiety, you on your podcast this week, the Reply All podcast, note the promotion there, you talk to a guy who has a very unusual way to motivate himself.
Yeah, we talked to a writer named Paul Ford, who also is a sort of website hoarder. He constantly buys websites. And he found himself dealing with sort of crippling anxiety, and he couldn't figure out how to deal with it. So he programmed a website where he would enter all of his anxieties and basically some syntax for a letter. And then it would automatically generate a letter based on all of his anxieties. So it would say to him, you know, hey, Paul, Don't worry about the fact that people say that your nose looks weird on Facebook. And, you know, you probably won't ever finish your book, but that's okay. You know, history might forget people who don't ever get anything done, but I'm sure your parents still love you. Like, it would send him like 12 of these a day.
So he's a masochist.
Well, you know, what he said was, once he externalized all of his anxiety, once he sort of put a face to it, I guess, it was so ridiculous to look at. It was so ridiculous to see all of these fears enumerated in an email. And he actually found himself replying to the emails to basically say, like, you know what? Go to hell. I'm not scared of you. I'm not scared of you anxieties. And it actually did have a really significant effect on his ability to move through the world. He became much less anxious.
Is that something you might want to adopt yourself?
You know, we experimented a lot with trying to write down our anxieties during the making of this episode, and it feels terrible. I want nothing to do with it. I think that it probably works very well for Paul, and I'm very happy for him, but it does not work as well for me.
For some of us, it's a bottomless pit. Yes.
That's right.
All right. Alex Goldman, co-host of the podcast Reply All. That's a show about the internet. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, Mark and Jay Duplass find magic in the mundane, or at least they try to, in their new HBO series, Togetherness. They're here after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. Mumblecore is a film genre of sort. Very little happens. Everyone acts pretty much like you and me. They're little low-budget films with a sense of the absurd. Brothers Mark and Jay Duplass are Mumblecore royalty with films like The Puffy Chair, Baghead, and The Dodeca Pentathlon.
How's life, bro? You happy?
Absolutely.
Look in my eyes and answer that.
I'm happy. So what about you? Are you happy?
No.
Then shut up about it.
Now the Duplass brothers have brought their funny, naturalistic take on everyday life to television with a show called Togetherness. It's about a young couple, her sister, and his best friend, all four living under one roof.
You're trying to edge me out.
I'm her sister.
I have no money.
What is your plan?
After I eat these Oreos or before?
I want to have fun with you.
I can't.
You can't? Just fake it. Do you see this smile? I'm dead inside.
Togetherness debuts Sunday night on HBO. Mark and Jay Duplass, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Well, what do you think about that Mumblecore label?
We don't like it anymore.
You don't?
We loved it for a minute when we were like 23 and making no-budget movies, and the New York Times wrote an article about us, and we're like, yay, they wrote about us. But I think it's getting reductive or something now. It's come to define anything that is micro-budgeted. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Our people enunciate pretty well in our stuff. We don't feel like they mumble that much.
Yeah, you can hear every word that they're saying.
There's not much of a core. I don't know.
We're also weirdly obsessed with plot. I mean, granted, our plot tends to be a little bit small compared to what big-budget Hollywood features would be. But Mark and I are constantly obsessed with the machinations of plot in our stuff. So in a weird way, although we have been considered the godfathers of the mumblecore movement, we've never really considered ourselves, part of any movement. We're really just kind of two brothers coming out of a cave trying to make a decent movie.
Have you ever had someone come to you and say, I really want you to be the godfather of our child? And you look at the child and you're like, I don't know if I really want to be your godfather. So that's where we're at.
Okay, so no more talk about the mumblecore. Let's talk about the plot of this show, Togetherness. And it is set in Eagle Rock here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. which happens to be where you live.
Yes, this is Jay. I live in Eagle Rock and Mark lives nearby in Los Feliz.
Okay, so it's shot in your world, literally. And it's about your world.
Mm-hmm.
So this is about the center is a couple. And Mark, you play the husband in this couple who have two small children and their marriage is a little shaky.
This is date night.
Yeah.
Yep.
What happens after this? What do you mean? It's not really an after.
Like, there's dessert, usually, and sometimes we'll stay here, or we'll go to, like, another place, too.
Yeah. We'll go to Froyo.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
I like frozen yogurt.
It's so good.
The toppings.
Yeah.
How's everybody like the wine?
Yeah, I play a guy named Brett in the show, and I'm married to Michelle, who's played by the fantastic actress Melanie Lynskey. And, you know, we're kind of doing all right on paper. We've got two kids, and we've got a nice house, and I have a job as a sound engineer, and happiness has not come to us easily. And I think what I love about these characters is it's not just this sort of approaching middle age, whiny malaise of the middle class. There's a deeply unsettled unhappiness, and they bang their heads against the wall constantly trying to find it, and they kind of pump their fists in the pursuit of happiness. And that's kind of how Jay and I experience the world. So we decided to build the show around them and also another couple who is kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum, played by Amanda Pete and our friend Steve Zissis, who have not found any traction, really. They don't have the jobs they want. They have not found romance. And they're kind of at that panic attack point where they're like, I don't know if this is going to happen for me as I'm approaching 40.
And, you know, I guess I have to ask the question, because you do set it in your real life and you are starring in it. And, you know, it seems like you're playing a version of yourself. Is this your life off screen?
It's really not our life per se, but I would say that you know, when we made our first feature called The Puffy Chair in like 2005, it was very representative of our world and what our friends were going through. We were constantly staying up late and having conversations about, is this the relationship that we're gonna go forever with? Are we gonna get married? Are we gonna break up? Everybody seemed to be dealing with that, and so while the characters aren't directly based on ourselves, they're definitely rooted in the conversation soup that we keep having at our dinner parties.
But it seems like what you just said in terms of your conversation soup, it seems like a pretty sad conversation.
Well, you know, at first it sounds sad, and like most of Mark's and my work, our conversations between each other starts with, you know, some horribly embarrassing or cringeworthy or sad thing that we're going through, and then we end up giggling about it a minute later because it's desperate and it's pathetic and it's funny. And hopefully what the show is transmitting is that feeling, is, you know, the ability to come watch your own desperation and your own desires and your own foibles and giggle about them afterwards.
There's a scene where Michelle and Brett, you Mark, are trying to spice up their sex life. Well, she is, at least. She's trying to spice it up. And he seems really resistant to this because he's not in favor of much change. It seems he's pretty conservative.
Right now, you're going to take a sip of that drink, then you're going to go straight to the bedroom.
I don't know what's happening right now. I feel like if you could just include me.
Do you want me to make you? I'll make you.
You're going to...
Just go, please. Just go.
Okay.
Go.
Did you want that scene to be, as you say, kind of this mixture of sadness and funny?
I think the funny-sad combo is something that we are obsessed with because it's kind of how we experience life, and we like to, you know, find scenes that help with that, in particular with that sort of, you know, one of the crazy sex scenes that happens with Brett and Michelle that you're talking about in the show. I find that that was a very specific thing, which was about what is it like when you're dealing with someone who is very, very rigid and unable to break out of their ways? And I think the average TV show that hits that would hit it really on the nose. And we tried to find a way in that was, you know, about someone who's sugar crashing and just really grumpy and want a banana, but their wife wants something else. And it's that little minutiae, I guess Jay and I refer to it as the epic smallness of life, that really gets us excited.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Mark and Jay Duplass. They have a new show out. It's called Togetherness, and it debuts Sunday on HBO right after Girls. And do you think that you're experiencing a different world in your late 30s than your parents did?
In our case, definitely. We definitely are. Yeah. We got started later, you know. Our parents had us pretty young, and we had kids much later. I feel like our path, and that's just particular to being artists, was fraught with so much stress and depression and
self-doubt
and failure. So the sine cosine wave was wildly disparate. And not to be reductive about our parents' lives, but they were a generation that, you know, went to law school to avoid going to war, got a great job. Our mom raised us. They were kind of on a fairly linear path.
But do you think that people now who are raising children are having a much different and much more difficult time negotiating that and their marital relations than people who are older?
I think the nature of problems change. You know, very specifically, one thing that we experience, and this is subconsciously represented in our show, is everyone is a transplant these days. You know, hardly anyone lives in the same city that they grew up in. In our experience, at least, and you're often left to fend for your family and your children without the help of aunts and uncles and parents. That's just one small detail that I think has changed the landscape and is particularly, you know, relevant in Los Angeles and New York, for instance.
Yeah, I think there's some gender differential to, you know, the roles of, in particular, what's expected of dads these days. You know, Jay and I are in equal partnerships with our wives where we make half the lunches and we do half the school drop-offs and half the bedtimes and half the teeth brushing and ass wiping. The whole thing happens half. And it certainly wasn't that way in our household when we were growing up. And I think that it does complicate some of the lines a little bit. And in particular, I find that a lot of dads we know and talk to feel a little confused sometimes as what exactly that role should be. Am I the dad who's going to work? Am I Mr. Mom? What's happening here?
Well, given the fact that you just said that you take on half the child-rearing roles, but now you're both really busy acting and putting together TV shows and movies and the like, how often are you really home to do all that, to be equal partners?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And, you know, Jay and I literally have conversations with the line producers and the first ADs of our show. And we say, how can we schedule this show so that we can, at the very least, drop our kids off at school or pick them up from school or be home to get them to sleep at night so that we don't disappear from their lives?
I mean, it's crazy, but we do schedule our shoots around our children's wake up times and bedtime. So the biggest factor that allows us to be present dads is we have absolutely zero social life.
Do you like all that togetherness?
You know, when everything is working within your family and everyone is in love and things are working out, there's no better feeling. There's no better moment than to just be, and I'm not talking big stuff, I'm just talking a dinner at 5:15 p.m. that goes off without a hitch. No one throws a fit. No one has a meltdown. Everyone gets through the dinner. That is a huge victory. And Mark and I guess, are pretty domestic guys at heart. I mean, that's what we love. That being said, achieving that is rare and challenging as hell. I mean, it's surprising how tough it is to pull that stuff off.
I mean, just to give you an example, we had the premiere of our show in Los Angeles last night, which, you know, we wanted to make good on our cast and crew and stay and talk to everybody. So we're there till 1 in the morning, and then we come home and we go to bed, and we have to get on a plane at 9 a.m. to come and do this interview, okay? So we do this, and my 2-year-old threw up on herself in the middle of the night, throwing the schedule off. So we have to throw her in the shower, get the lunches made. I don't have time to shower or pack. I throw my 7-year-old in the car, drive her to school so that we can have good time together, but she's fussy. And I'm thinking the whole time, like, why do I do this to myself when there are people who didn't get married and didn't have children, and they sit and they read not only a book, but a series of books with coffee. And what the hell am I doing? And then I drop my daughter off, and she gives me this huge hug and says, I don't want you to go. I want you to stay with me today. And we have this little magical moment. And then I think, all right, it's worth it.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking the time that you did to speak with me.
Yeah,
thanks
thank
so
you
much.
For
we
having
really,
us.
We really love what you do. So thanks for having us.
Thank you. That's Mark and Jay Duplass. They're writers, directors, and producers of the new HBO show Togetherness, and it premieres this Sunday at 9:30 on HBO. Speaking of togetherness, Warren Olney is here in the studio with me. We are together.
We are together once again. We're going to talk about, I suppose you could call it, some togetherness in France. We'll go there and talk to the people who say, according to the Economist magazine, to one of the members of the French National Assembly that we spoke to, a Muslim woman who lives in Paris, that there really is a sense of national unity that as such as has not been seen before. There are also reports, of course, of some attacks on mosques and backlash of the sort that they're all trying to avoid. Particularly the member of the National Assembly who just is going to come out and talk to us out of a meeting that he's having with church leaders, with leaders of various mosques around the country, all of whom are trying to foster this idea of unity. We're all together. We are all Charlie Hebdo. And it's just very interesting what's happening there. And then there are others who will say, you know, talk in terms of what we might expect for the future.
Okay. Look forward to that very important discussion at 1 o'clock on To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you. And coming up on this program, Senator Barbara Boxer is leaving the Senate next year. Who will try to replace her? That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. After 22 years in the Senate, Barbara Boxer said today she will not run for re-election in 2016. She made the announcement by posting a video on her website in which her grandson interviews her about the decision.
Has your age played a role in your decision?
Finally, the question the reporters love to ask. No, definitely not Zach.
Care to expand?
Here's the thing. Some people are old at 40. And some people are young at 80. It depends on the person. As for me, I feel as young as I did when I got elected. I was in my 50s when I got elected to the Senate.
So, are you retiring?
Zach, I am never going to retire. The work is too important, but I will not be running for the Senate in 2016.
Barbara Boxer is 74, by the way. She was elected to the House back in 1983. She won her Senate seat in 1992 and has since been an aggressive defender of abortion rights and environmental protections. And the race for Boxer's seat, just hours old at this point, is already fodder for rampant speculation. Joe Garofoli is the politics reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with Senator Boxer's path to Congress. How did it begin?
She started out as a county supervisor in Marin County here north of San Francisco and worked her way up. She became went to Congress, and then in the days of she kind of made a mark for herself in during the Clarence Thomas hearings and got herself elected to the Senate in 1992, along with Dianne Feinstein in the quote-unquote year of the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said in the intro, she has been a staunch supporter of environmental rights and abortion rights, and a one of the more liberal members of Congress.
Right, and she's been known to get creative when it comes to achieving her goals, especially women's rights. Here she is. Let's play a clip of tape of her reprising a tune that she sang to male colleagues back in the 80s when the gym was for men only.
Exercise, glamorize. Where to go will you advise? Can't everybody use your gym?
Okay, so that was from an
interview.
Not
too many senators you want to hear sing.
She rhymes a lot. She sings a lot. But she made her point, and the gym then became a co-ed.
Exactly, and she was also one of the people out front about the investigation or pushing for an investigation the former into you know, the sexual advances made by former Senator Bob Packwood, who was an Oregon Republican. She was some senators got ticked off because she was doing things that were not kind of in the milieu of the old boys club of the Senate, which likes to tout itself as a very august body, but it, you know, and she stirred things up there.
What are her major legislative achievements?
I'm sorry, you cut out there.
Oh, what are her major legislative achievements, do you think?
She's done a couple of things. She's done some for environmental law. One thing I want to start to, we've talked about some of the stuff that she's done. One thing she wasn't able to get done is when the Senate did have, there was a majority in the Senate, the Democratic majority in the Senate, and also in the House, she wasn't able to push for climate change. And that is going to be sort of a, I'm imagining a regret on her part. She, you know, where she was about, you know, doing some of these things and a staunch liberal supporter, she wasn't able to make the connections that they were able to bring that type of legislation home. There still is no sort of federal climate change legislation that in that brief window where Democrats could have done it, she wasn't able to pull it off.
Okay, so she is a powerful liberal voice. She's been in the Senate for a couple of decades. What do you think this means with her retiring? What do you think it means for the progressive wing in the Senate?
The odds on favorites to replace her are have very, very similar type of policy stance. The leading candidates are the people, they haven't declared yet, of course, but the people who are likely to run, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, State Attorney General Kamala Harris, Tom Steyer, these folks are all very much left of center, and certainly when compared to the rest of the U.S. Senate. So I don't think that voice will be missing. It'll just be a different type of voice.
Well, let's talk about those top three. Gavin Newsom, do you think that he actually will consider running for the Senate? And and what are his chances if he does?
That's the big question, whether it's going to be, at least from this end of the woods, Newsom or Harris. They both have a very similar. They have very similar policy stands. They have a similar fundraising base, similar donors. They're both from the Bay Area, and it's thought that they're going to have to try and figure out who's running for this seat and who is running for Jerry Brown's the governor's seat when his term expires in 4 years. The conventional wisdom, and from what I've heard, is that Newsom would probably be more likely to run for the Senate for temperamental reasons. He's an ideas guy, and that might be better suited for the Senate. Harris runs a very large state bureaucracy right now, the Attorney General's office. That might be better suited for the governor. Newsom has also run the city of San Francisco, which is also a bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Tom Steyer would have a bottomless, bank account to draw upon, and he would really force the issue with both of these folks.
And Tom Steyer is the billionaire who is advocating legislation on climate change. He puts a lot of his money behind trying to prevent climate change.
Right. He spent, around $80 million just in the midterms around the country this year. Two mixed results. But he has never held public office. He would have some baggage. He's, run a hedge fund. That would certainly not be, in the boxer tradition of someone who is always advocating for people, the less fortunate among folks. That would be a tough one to overcome, even though he does have many of the same policy stands as Boxer.
Right. Well, speaking of baggage, Gavin Newsom has some baggage, sex scandal in the past, and maybe that might be a turnoff for some more conservative voters.
It may, although, you're not going to get, Newsom was never really going to line up a lot of conservative voters anyways. None of those three are.
Mm-hmm.
And you figure that there's no Republican bench here in California. There's really, there's no one with either the name recognition or the money to run. I saw a couple people, I think these are reporters from back east, saying Carly Fiorina may run again. I mean, she doesn't even live in the state anymore. That's not going to happen. And I don't think Meg Whitman is going to run again. She's, firmly ensconced as in Silicon Valley, back in Silicon Valley.
What about Sheryl Sandberg?
Sheryl Sandberg has said numerous times she has no interest in running, but even no matter how many times people ask her, and I think she reiterated that today, Yeah, she's not. She has no interest in running, and again, no political experience other than someone who's held fundraisers for people.
Any chance at all that Governor Brown would say, "You know what? I think I might do this."
Anyone who can say they can predict what the governor's going to do is lying. But he is. He seems to be content at this point with staying in the governor's mansion. You know what he has said he would do. Would be to come back and run and be mayor of Oakland again.
Oh, wow. Okay, Joe Garofoli, politics reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hello, Julie Myers. What are they telling us?
At first, I want to make an announcement.
I'm really
very happy where I am right now. I really like my job. The people of California, I think, really need me, and I think I've got more work to do here.
You sound like a certain mayor of a certain big city that we live in.
Maybe I was reading his tweet verbatim. Perhaps.
Okay,
so earlier in the show, back to feedback, we talked about media organizations that are censoring the controversial images from Charlie Hebdo. You all had a lot to say about it on Facebook. Carlo Ratti says, come on, censor the images and the terrorists win. Brian Stokes says that journalists who censor this stuff are falling down on the job. We're supposed to believe that journalists are the protectors of the First Amendment, not when they do something like this. Matthew Snyder says, didn't we all just freak out when Sony pulled the interview and cowed to North Korea? Come on. Jared Rather says that these images should be published as widely as possible, everywhere. The terrorists can't kill everyone, can they? Dabney Ross Jones says that it's amazing that some news organizations will publish photos of beaten wives, dead bodies lying on the ground, and Kim Kardashian breaking the internet, but are too afraid to post a cartoon. And Robert Fernandez took a more nuanced view than most. He says that he understands the desire of an editor to protect his or her staff, but acquiescing to terrorists is just not okay. It's the journalist's job to expose injustice, not hide from it.
All right. We'd love to hear more from you if you'd like to weigh in on anything you've heard on the air here at Press Play on KCRW. Our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play or Facebook KCRW Press Play. Thank you, Julie Myers, for that and for wading through all the comments that we do receive. And Warren Olney, to the point up next, he's going to continue the story of the fallout resulting from the shootings in Paris yesterday. So stay tuned for that at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.